connecting to the internet.
Internet.
Networking software.
World Wide Web for web.
Computer today.
Computer.
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 NetSurfer Pro.
Welcome to NetSurfer Pro, a whirlwind ride through the World Wide Web. I'm your host, Matthew Marissa, and with me is...
your co-host, Galen.
And... you smell that?
Hang on.
It smells like a dumpster fire?
Oh, no.
That's right. We have an early frontrunner for dumpster fire of the year. The Morbius of video games, as said by streamer Jabroni Mike, or was it Vinny Pizza Pasta? I don't remember which of the two members of Red Fox called it the Morbius of video games. But of course, I'm talking about the Lord of the Rings Gollum.
Yeah.
Can I just explain a few things really quick?
No, please do. I have seen the Vinny Vine Sauce, the Vinny Pizza Pasta video, and I want you to explain to the audience what Lord of the Rings Gollum is.
Okay, we all know Gollum, right? Lord of the Rings is like one of the biggest, most well-known fantasy series ever. It's classic. We all know Gollum. He's the little freak who goes, "My precious!"
Yeah.
And he, like, steals the ring, and he eats a finger, and... yeah, he's, like, the freak, the weirdo. He accepts that what's in my pocket is a valid riddle when he should have said, "No, that's a bad riddle. Redo." So, okay, what do you think a Gollum video game would be?
Canceled for one.
Yeah.
But number two, I don't know, maybe like the search for the ring. Like, I'm fairly certain that there is a breadth of time where it's like, and then 1,000 years happen and Gollum just gets progressively more and more fucked up because of the ring. Don't correct me or quote me on that. I don't know, Lord of the Rings, but like, you know, I don't know, a stealth game, like a weird, like, climbing, crafting game.
Well, you're sort of right.
Yeah.
So they decided, okay, for one thing, they decided, let's make a game about Gollum. Everyone wants to play a game about Gollum. There's untapped story potential there that the Tolkien estate is willing to cede to us, these game developers. Then they decided to make it a stealth game with platforming elements, a lot of climbing, very Prince of Persia-y, very loose platforming. There's some Team Ico elements of, like, guiding around other people and telling them to do things.
I hate that you just said there's some Team Ico elements in relation to Lord of the Rings Gollum, but I can't necessarily refute
Think of The Last Guardian. If the main character was a little tiny freak who eats fingers, and instead of a bird, it's another prisoner. By
it's
the way,
guy.
You're in, like, Sauron's prison, or just a prison in Mordor, and most of the game is doing tasks in prison, and eventually you break out, but you have to do a lot of prison tasks, or you follow along an old guy, and just, like...
Yeah, you follow along an old guy and you do tasks for, like, the orcs,
mm-hmm.
which is also just like, my favorite thing in video games is taking orders and not breaking out of prison.
Yeah, then there is some stealth segments, but also it's insta-death if you get caught. And when I say insta-death, there's no animation of you dying. Anytime you die, it pretty much just immediately goes to a "you died" screen. Not like Dark Souls, where there's some, like, flair to it and some, you know, there's sort of a buildup and an effect to it and an impact. It's just...
yeah, it, like, there's a moment in the Vinny Vine Sauce video, which we will heavily recommend just as a little taste of how fucked up this is, where, like, you jump into lava... and you would probably expect, you know, you can probably expect this. It's a very Bowser-ish death, except it's kind of like, it's like, bah, death. Like, it's like, you know, there's like a half second to maybe a second of, like, some kind of, you just died animation. And then immediately you get the overlay that's like, you died, reload from last checkpoint. They turned Lord of the Rings, they took Gollum and made, like, a PS2 era platformer out of it, but not even a good one.
Yeah, yeah, it's a bad PS2 era platformer. Contrast that to Hi-Fi Rush, which feels like a PS2 character action platformer game, but really good. Gollum is just, like... garbage. The UI design's unfinished. The only neat thing I would say is the minigame where you have to convince Smeagol to let you do things.
Yeah.
You know how Gollum has, like, the split personality thing going on, and navigating that is a mechanic, which is interesting.
Yeah. Like,
it's I feel like if this was, like, a visual novel, it would have been way better.
Yeah.
Because, like, I mean, I guess I get sneaking, but you know, there's an entire group of like two characters to three characters in the books whose whole point was sneaking.
Yeah, that's the thing, is like, it's okay, not to bring up the book series that shall not be, that should not be discussed, but it's like if they made a Dobby video game instead of like, I don't know, a Cedric Diggory video game.
Don't
like,
give them ideas.
Fair enough. You have to collect socks.
Wait, that's SpongeBob.
Oh, dang it. Oh, good.
Okay, yeah.
This means that they can't make that video game, though, so we're safe for now.
So the obvious thing is that this game was rushed and unfinished to meet a deadline, and it's not the fault of the designers directly. It's most likely management that led to this, because it's very clearly, like, anyone who looks at it could probably tell it's unfinished. And, like, I'm not trying to say that is outright the fault of the people who made the game directly. It's, like, clearly there's something amiss, you know?
Yeah.
At what point did the people in charge say, like, did they say we wasted too much money on this, it needs to come out to recuperate costs? Did they, like, nobody was waiting for the Gollum game. It's not like Cyberpunk where people were, you know, worried about their pre-orders and taking off work to play it, you know?
Yeah.
Like nobody was expecting this to come out and be a huge success. So they could have like, I don't know, put more time in the oven, but I guess they just didn't want to spend more money.
Yeah. Like the only thing I can guess is that this was part of like a big flight of games, a fantasy flight of games, you could say.
Mm-hmm.
That, like, you know, once Shadow of Mordor came out and it was like, oh, we can expand the lore and, you know, people will actually enjoy it if we do a good job. Like, I can only assume there was kind of a thing where it's like, ah, we're going to make, you know, this game and this game and this game. And this was one of them. And then everything just, like, it just sort of suffered from a bad idea on the face of it, given to bad management and given to, like, overworked developers. Also, by the way, Daedric Entertainment is the developers and not the publishers, but Daedric Entertainment, possibly best known for the Deponia video games.
Yeah, I've heard.
And for publishing Barotrauma, which is honestly really interesting.
Yeah.
Like, Barotrauma is actually a really interesting video game that I kind of want to play. But point being, like,
they've made adventure games in the past, and I feel like a LucasArts style adventure game would have been a perfect fit.
Yeah. It's like they've made games that seem like they would have worked better, but I don't know, maybe it's also like, well, we can't make this a point and click adventure. Look what happened to Telltale. I don't know. It's so strange. It's a confluence of so many poor decisions, like, and then just not being given enough time to polish anything, and it comes out with one of the funniest products to ever exist.
The Morbius of video games.
It really is. I hope we can convince them to re-release it.
Yeah. Re-release it in GameStop a second time.
Oh, goodness. I love it. I love dumpster fires. This is a very fun dumpster fire.
Convince the GME crowd to hold on to Gollum Games to save GameStop.
Yeah. I believe when Ride to Hell Retribution came out, Yahtzee was like, everyone should buy this. It'll make people so confused. I want that to happen with Gollum. I want everyone to buy Lord of the Rings Gollum, despite the fact it's a terrible product.
Yeah.
Oh, goodness. So
that was just a quick aside, a quick 10-minute aside, but now we're going into the meat of our episode. And if you might remember, we said at the beginning of this year that this is going to be the year of the album.
Yes. We have a number of albums that we are putting on the docket, and this happens to be one of them. And I'm actually even more excited for this episode, because this happens to be one that I listened to multiple times before this episode, and you are the one who has only really listened to it recently for this.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
It's a real switcheroo.
A real swappy derby.
A real humdinger.
A real 9.5 yards.
A real Housewives of whatever that the name of that was.
A real flip floppers.
A real big fish.
Close.
But not real big fish, because it's not ska. This is folk punk.
Yes. So, folk punk, before we get into the album and the band itself that we're talking about today. So, I did some sort of research on this. Folk punk is sort of an umbrella term that covers a few different subgenres. For today, we're mainly focusing on American folk punk. But generally, the idea is that it combines sort of traditional folksy instruments from whatever like culture it's in with punk stylings, production, lyrics, themes, writing, etc. The punk concept, the je ne sais quoi. And it's often also very DIY, as we will probably get into as we discuss this album. The sort of proto examples include things like Violent Femmes and the Pogues. The Pogues later would sort of give way to Celtic punk, which is one of the big subgenres, which includes things like Dropkick Murphys or Flogging Mollies, which tend to take sort of traditional Celtic instruments like bagpipes and mix them in with punk sound. There's also a genre I'm not sure if it's really okay to say the name that Wikipedia has it listed as, so I'm just going to say Roma punk, as Gogol Bordello, that includes a lot of traditional sort of Romani instrumentation into the music, a lot of accordion, for example.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there's American folk punk, which is sort of inspired also by acts like Bob Dylan and Woody Guthrie, I think, is named in the album we're talking about today. Yes,
Woody Guthrie, a prolific songwriter and singer in his own right.
Yeah, so sort of taking inspiration from those old folk artists and giving them new life.
Yeah. Fun fact, if you know the song, and you probably do, because there's a very good chance you're from the U.S., if you know the song This Land Is Your Land, that was written by Woody Guthrie, and it is a socialist song. It got scrubbed afterwards, like a lot of good socialist art. But yeah, no, Woody Guthrie was a hardcore like socialist and pretty much an out-and-out communist.
Mm-hmm.
So, based.
Yeah. So, throughout like the 80s and some of the early 90s, the genre was kind of dormant. However, in the early to mid to late 90s, it started to pick up a lot more steam. Notable acts from this time include things like Moldy Peaches, very early Modest Mouse, like Lonesome Crowded West is very folk punky, and previously discussed on this show, Neutral Milk Hotel.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then in the 2000s is when the genre started to really become what we know today. Part of this was because of the way a lot of these sort of punk labels would work. The record labels would sign sort of a specific genre and only that genre. And so people would then sort of look at similar acts on the same label to find more of that genre. Think of how when we talked about Infinity on High, we mentioned Fueled by Ramen, which signed Fall Out Boy and Panic and Paramore.
Yeah.
In this case, at first, it was Asian Man Records. Shouts out to Mike Park, by the way. Which also was a mainly, like, ska and ska punk label, but they did a lot of the early folk punk as well.
Nice.
Later, so this is sort of where it takes an unfortunate term. The main folk punk label was Planet X. However, due to the sort of outing of one of the co-founders of Planet X as being a sexual abuser, the record label disbanded, and the acts that were on it don't associate anymore with them.
Yeah.
But for historical reasons, that was sort of a big reason why folk punk grew into what it is because there was a record label that produced and released and managed them, and they would all tour together. And this is where we get things like Kepi Ghouli, Pat the Bunny, aka Johnny Hobo, and the...
Oh, Johnny Hobo and the Freight Trains.
Yeah. And of course, AJJ.
Yes.
Which takes us to...
The Fact Corner.
The Fact Corner.
So, hello, I'll be your host this week for The Fact Corner.
Ooh.
So, AJJ the band. Formerly their name was Andrew Jackson Jihad, which, while it is a good name, they changed in 2016, because A, Andrew Jackson is a piece of shit, and B, none of them are Muslim, and so they were like, we don't really feel like we should be the ones to use the term jihad in our name, which I think is cool on them personally, mm-hmm. even if the original name is also a really good name. But AJJ is certainly not a bad one either. The main members, or at least the two very consistent members from the founding of the band, are Sean Bonnet, who is the lead vocalist and acoustic guitar player, and Ben Gallaty, who plays bass and backing vocals. Current members, like as in current to this day, because this is a band that is around to this day, include Preston Bryant, Mark Glick, and Kevin Higuchi, who is the most recent. From 2021, they were touring. They are, as noted, a folk punk band, although Wikipedia does note that they have some elements of anti-folk, which is kind of a... I mean, much like any movement, it's kind of a counter example to the movement, but it's also very internal to them. It's usually kind of using the stylings of folk to make music that is a little bit less folk. I think the best example on this album would be Bad Bad Things, which we will get to. But point being, they are a experimental band who likes to mostly play folk punk, but they often have sort of examples and counterexamples within their own music. They are a rather prolific band, having toured alongside, and I have just some names here, so one second. The Queers, Bomb the Music Industry, Jeff Rosenstock separately outside of Bomb the Music Industry. They have released splits with Mischief Brew, Ghost Mice, Cobra Skulls, French Quarter, The Gunshi.
I love that boss.
I want to be the Gunshi, personally speaking. Yeah, they have been around for a very long time, and they've been doing this so long to the point where they have literally been doing it to this day. Their most recent album with Hopeless Records was Disposable Everything, which came out May 26, 2023.
Wait a minute, that was like 5 days ago.
Yeah, that's like literally a week ago from this recording. Yeah, didn't realize that was a thing, or else... I would have listened to that if I had known that was a thing before the episode, so I could be like, oh, hey, go listen to it. But generally speaking, I also just kind of like their music outside of this album as well. So I don't know. Maybe go listen to it. It's probably good.
By the way, I wanted to mention that Bomb the Music Industry and Jeff Rosenstock, by extension, were both signed under Asian Man Records. So
yes,
that tour happened while they were still signed to Asian Man Records as well.
Yes. In fact, People Who Can Eat People, which is the album that we are talking about today, was specifically published by Asian Man Records as well. Goodness me.
Let's go, Mike Park.
For just a couple of specific facts about the album itself. People Who Can Eat People Are the Luckiest People in the World, which is the name of the album, was released in 2007, specifically September 11th, 2007, which is... pretty funny. The band at the time was Sean and Ben, as well as John De La Cruz on drums and Dylan Cook on vocals. The title of the album is, quote, derived from a line in Kurt Vonnegut's novel Hocus Pocus, which itself is a reference to Barbara Streisand's song People. It was recorded at Audio Confusion in Mesa, Arizona. The album artwork is illustrated by Ryan Piscatelli, and the line that the Barbara Streisand song is presumably referenced by Kurt Vonnegut, which is then referenced by the band, is people who need people are the luckiest people in the world. So there's a little bit of fun history for you. But yes, now we can get out of the fact corner. Just gonna pick up this corner and just boot it stage right.
Yeah, you can pick up entire corners. It's weird how you can bend space like that, but it's actually really cool to watch.
Well, see my stand, and now I have to come up with a really fun, real humdinger of a stand name.
My stand. Stand. No one's made that joke before, trust me. So I wanted to talk a bit about sort of just a few interesting things about the sound of this record. Now we're a real music podcast. We say record instead of album.
Yes.
Yeah. So first thing is that the folk instrumentation here, they use a lot of acoustic guitars. I think they only use acoustic instruments, no electronic like distortion or anything. The drums, like the percussion's really interesting because it feels like it's very light on percussion a lot of the time.
Yeah.
It uses a lot of stomping.
Yeah.
In a very sort of like merry band sort of way. And I think there might be some other like folksy percussion I mean, I'm sure there's, like, drums, like, normal, but they don't use that as often. It's much more focused on the strings and the vocals, especially. The vocals being mixed, like, way higher than everything else.
Yeah.
There is some horns and a sort of bells in one song, but for the most part, it's about the strings, some fiddle, some banjo, some guitar, all layered on top of each other to sort of a chorus of instruments. I also wanted to say that it feels like they didn't have soundproofing in the recording booth.
Yeah.
Which gives it a very DIY feel. It's like, so I don't know, like, how apparent this is to, you know, a lot of people, but I found that since I started working on audio production, I'm a lot more sensitive to these sort of things. And it really sounds like the singer, Sean, I believe.
Sean, yes.
It sounds like the singer, Sean, is, like, in a big room. Like, there's a bit of an echo. He's, like, a ways away from the microphone. There's a lot of space around the singer that I can sort of pick up through the audio.
Yeah. And that's not even getting into, like, the bits of the album that are, like, literally supposed to, like, seemingly supposed to be, like, off-mic conversations that they then put onto the songs themselves.
Yeah.
Like, you know the moment in Aeroplane where at the very end of one of the songs, somebody goes, holy shit, off mic?
Yeah.
Which is a really good moment. It's kind of like that. There's a moment on Personal Space Invader, the 10th song, where, like, it literally starts with, like, the opening line of the song, but it's, like, a little bit more muted, as though he's, like, as though Sean is, like, you know, essentially demonstrating what the other members should do. I think People also opens with kind of like a you know, all right, let's go kind of thing. Yeah, it feels very intentional. Like, it feels a little sloppy, but that a little sloppiness feels intentionally selected into the album. You could have easily cut off that opening part of Personal Space Invader, for example, but they didn't. And that, so it feels like this is specifically intending to give it this kind of vibe.
Right. It also sounds like it's mono mic, or not mono, but like one mic.
Yeah.
Because it feels like the backup instruments are just quieter and softer. This is especially apparent in something like, I want to say Survival Song, when they have an actual chorus from the back.
Yeah.
Of all these different people singing together. He says, like, pick up the Do-Re-Mi boys.
Yeah, yeah. Do-Re-Mi, which is a line from a Woody Guthrie song.
And it's very apparent that, like, these people are in the back relative to the singer. And it doesn't feel like they're just recorded and then mixed down. I could be wrong, though.
Yeah.
Sort of how it sounds to me, having, you know, done audio production.
Yeah. The way that the actual sausage was made, we aren't 100% certain on, but we can theorize, and the way that it came out ultimately does sound good. Now, I also want to mention that the reason we're talking about this, in addition to this being a good album, is because this is a part of the MuCore
I forgot, yeah, this is MuCore.
Yeah, this is one of the...
It's white guys talking about their feelings.
I was literally about to say, bringing that through line, it's, yeah, white guys talking about being sad and a little socially inept and just, you know, the weight of the world on them, which, you know, honestly, again, this is a great album. That's, like, no shame on them. This is really, really good. We say this slash affectionate.
I mean, I'm gonna shame Mew.
I mean, yeah, we can shame Mew. Mew you can shame all day.
Yeah.
Not the Pokemon, though.
Or the BlazBlue character. Actually, maybe a little bit for the BlazBlue character. Not the Pokemon.
Hey, hate the BlazBlue player, not the BlazBlue game.
No. So yeah. I think what this all comes together in is an album that sounds sloppy and immature in terms of its production. It sounds like a bedroom producer before bedroom producers were a thing.
Yeah.
But, like, in doing so, it creates this very endearing of the people feel.
Yeah.
I think the way I would describe listening to this album is it sounds like a bunch of people hitched a ride on a boxcar and this is the music they played.
Ah, I like that. That's a good descriptor.
Yeah.
Fittingly enough, I was about to draw other parallels to Johnny Hobo and the Freight Trains.
Exactly.
I don't remember the name of the specific album that I really like from them, but a lot of their songs have that feel as well, where it's like they literally seem like they were recorded in a random room with a bunch of people singing a chorus and a couple people who could play an instrument.
Mm-hmm.
But with that said, let's get just right into it, why don't we?
Okay.
With the very first song, Rejoice.
Rejoice.
So Rejoice is, I think, a very good thesis statement for basically the rest of the album, which is a phrase that I'm certain I've said before, but I'm going to just continue to say it because it's true. Rejoice, if I could boil it down, is essentially, hey, wake up, be happy. The world sucks, but you're still alive.
Well, I think it's more so that it's not like you don't have to only celebrate when things go right, but because you are attempting to do things correctly or do things right, then that's worth celebrating.
Yeah.
It says, like, rejoice for you're trying your hardest or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, rejoice because you're trying your best is the last line.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah. I.
It's
I,
not a simple just, like, why are you so sad? Be happy.
Yeah.
It's more complicated and more about celebrating the act of existing and fighting through existence.
Yeah, I like that it opens with, like, the opening lyrics are about, like, God coming back, and he's, like, this massive, horrible, like, creature, just kind of, like, his arms are burning witches, his heads perform hexes, I think is the line. And it's like, you know, it's a fun irony of, you know, everybody rejoice, God's come back, and he's killing a bunch of people. And I think that's sort of lending to the idea of, like, the world itself is out to get you. The you know, life itself is probably shitty right now, but you have to rejoice because you're out here trying your best. You have to remember to just kind of wake up and try.
I just want to say, Sean singing is definitely going to be hit or miss for people.
Yes.
There's a lot of emotions. It sounds like he's crying whenever he's singing, but also screaming.
Yeah, yeah. Sean Bennett has a very emotion-filled voice, and that can be good or bad depending on your music tastes.
But even, not even emotion, like, it's not, it doesn't sound sort of classically trained. His voice falters a lot, it doesn't hold notes well. There's not a lot of vibrato.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't have the hallmarks of a good singer, quote unquote. And I think that adds, again, to the DIY aesthetic.
Yeah.
Working man.
I would say that, one, some of their later stuff, they definitely have learned from it. And the like, literal singing quality seems to have gone up. Which doesn't mean that it is inherently better, but that's just sort of like, if you don't necessarily like this, you might still like some of their later stuff if it's really just the voice that's grating.
I feel like this falls into the Mew Obstacle Course Kaizo edition of albums, where it feels like a lot of Mewcore is stuff that most people would find hard to listen to. And there's sort of it's like a gamer pride.
Yeah.
You know what? You know how people will play, you know, games on the hardest difficulty, or even just the fact that beating Dark Souls without summons or, you know, any help is, like, considered the true measure of a gamer. It's like, it feels like oftentimes the Mew core chart and Mew as a whole is like, oh, you know, real music is Animal Collective and 10 Tricks Point Never.
Yeah,
and there's a lot of things that are not considered easy listening and maybe considered difficult listening.
Yeah.
And I mean, I like 10 Tricks Point Never from time to time, but I can't help but feel a sense of sort of elitism. And this feels weird because I'm saying that somebody's singing voice is hard to listen to, but I feel like that's sort of just a fact at times.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, no shade on Sean from AJJ. It works beautifully in this context. And I think the fact that it is not easy listening is okay with them, because sort of the rest of the album isn't really easy listening either.
Yeah.
Every other component is not pop, per se.
Yeah. It is meant to evoke the feelings, the trappings of folk. It is meant to evoke, like, a bunch of people just kind of getting together and using what they have to make music.
It is about the emotion and the location. In the setting.
Yeah. A common thing that I've said every once in a while is that this is a positive and a negative in some instances, but the reason that I like some of the music I like is because you don't have to actually be able to sing it, which, honestly, again, I will even come to bat for Sean. I think Sean has a pretty good singing voice, especially nowadays, like, especially in the later songs. But yeah, that's the warning is this might be a little much.
I think it's good singing, but it's also hard to listen to at times.
Yeah.
And I think you can have both and still appreciate it.
Yeah, it's like Okusenmon.
Yeah, exactly. So next song, Brave as a Noun, beautiful song.
Excellent song.
Maybe the standout of the album in terms of like singles, I would say. Okay, quick thing. This album's like 27 minutes long.
Yeah.
It's a short album.
This is a short listen.
There were so many times listening to this that I was like, is this just like another movement of the song? No, it's just like three songs in a row that have no gap. So it sounds like they're one continuous song. But, you know, that also means they're not really radio singles in the sense they're not like the 3 minute, you know, here's the point that you listen to by itself, and then this is the thing that makes you buy the album.
Yeah.
It's more so all of the songs are, you know, you could listen to them on their own, but they definitely play a certain way when you listen to the album together. And I think the length of the tracks, or rather the lack of length, is part of the reason.
Yeah. Brave as a Noun, I know that a roommate of mine has on their, like, liked playlist or on something on their Spotify that they don't then have Survival Song, which it goes immediately into.
This is a Discover Weekly song.
Yeah, exactly. It's like this and Cocopelli Face Tattoo are the two that really AJJ seems to be on with Spotify with.
Coco Pebbles Face Tattoo? Like the prize in the box?
No, actually it's Coco Melon's Face Tattoo.
Oh, okay.
Like the prize in the video. Yeah, so Brave as a Noun is a wonderful little song, wonderful little ditty. I sing it to myself constantly. I sing a lot of these songs to myself constantly. It's kind of like a weird sort of, I would call it like a bit of expression of existential angst, because like the start of the song is sort of like, hey, there's sort of technically nothing stopping me from just sort of like killing all of my friends, you know? But then it gets into kind of like, but I would never be able to do that because I'm, you know, I'm scared and I'm sad and I'm angry. And it's sort of like a lot of internal conflict just sort of suddenly getting belted out. The chorus ends up being, and it's sad to know that we are not alone. And it's sad to know there's no honest way out.
I think that's so interesting because it belies a sense of empathy.
Yeah.
Like the idea that like not only are we suffering, but we know that other people are suffering too.
Like, yeah.
It's looking at your own situation and instead of just saying like, woe is me, taking it a step further in really sort of digging into the existential part of it, the part of it that sort of applies, I don't want to say to everyone, but to everyone.
Yeah. It is a profound sadness of knowing that not only is your life probably not going the way you want, but realistically, most of the people you know, their life isn't going the way they want either. And it's kind of a shared sadness. But I do like the addition at the very end, the second chorus, which leads into Survival Song, which is, in this life we leave, we could conquer everything if we could just get the brave to get out of bed in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, a lot of the songs that we're going to describe are things where we'll probably talk about it, and you might be like, dang, that sounds very sad. And it's like, yeah, but, you know, it's also not.
Yeah, I think
some of the times it's very sad, and some of the times it's, you know, it's using that sadness, but then it's going like, yeah, but, you know, that's why we're here still.
I mean, I think this continues the theme from Rejoice of there is sadness, but we can fight it.
Yeah, yeah.
I also wanted to just say this does one of my favorite things in songwriting, which is where the verse kind of doesn't end the way you think it would.
Yeah.
You know, when you think of a verse, it tends to have an ending point. And I'm not a music theorist, again. So this is not going to be, you know, the academic description. But usually when you talk about sort of popular songwriting, the verse sort of terminates usually lower and then it picks up in the chorus.
Yeah.
The first verse here doesn't really terminate lower. It's a little lower than the previous note, but it feels like it's still hanging on something.
Yeah.
When he says depressing. It doesn't go down the way you think. It doesn't really give you closure. And then it leads into the chorus. And I think that's like super interesting because it brings so much emphasis retroactively into that last word of the verse.
Yeah.
So brave as a noun leads to survival song.
Yes.
I bet you can't guess what this one's going to be about thematically.
The recurring phrase is that's how I learned how to survive, or that's how we learned how to survive. Yeah, it's kind of a continuation of just sticking in there. But this is also a very interesting song lyrically because there's an entire section that is just lifted wholesale from Do Re Mi by Woody Guthrie. Mm-hmm. Also a very good song, by the way. There are references as well where they do that chorus. They do that chorus from Do Re Mi, and then they immediately say, "We just ripped off Woody Guthrie," which is very fun. I like this. This is a very there's a certain amount of humor in this album that I love.
I think the humor in moments like that really helps sort of breach the severity, the sadness, the depression of the lyrics.
Yeah.
You know, there's a certain mood that has to be maintained of melancholy cheer. And I think having those humorous moments like that really helps move it along.
Yeah. I believe the final line of that particular stanza is, "I fed false information to the audience" as well, which is, again, I love it. Yeah, survival song, like, Brave as a Noun into survival song is its own, like, essentially just a single song. But survival song as the second half, I would say it's slightly weaker than Brave as a Noun. I think Brave as a Noun is a lot better self-contained than survival song is separated from Brave as a Noun. But the natural progression, I think, does work very well as kind of a counterbalance to Brave as a Noun, where Brave as a Noun is kind of a bit of bemoaning of not being braver as a person, whereas Survival Song is a lot more about just accepting and acknowledging and, you know, realizing the amount of effort it takes just to survive.
It's sort of about how you can grow from traumatic experiences. Not that you need traumatic experiences to grow, but, like, you can take those and turn those into betterment.
Yeah.
You can grow from these things to make sure, you know, you don't do it again to other people. You can survive through that.
Yeah.
That, I guess, in a way, like, you don't really learn how to survive until you've been faced with hardships. But because you get faced with hardships doesn't mean that's a failure on your part.
Yeah. It's, again, good song. Mm-hmm. We get on to Bad Bad Things. This is one I always skip. I don't think it's a bad song. Bad Bad Song, more like. So Bad Bad Things, I want to preface this by saying that this is a song that's kind of like, essentially the premise here is that the singer is singing about killing your family.
Yeah.
And I want to be very specific when I say that the reason that I skip this is not because it's like, it's not because I listen to it and I'm like, why would they sing about that? I'm a big fan of challenging art, and I'm a big fan of, like, I think this is an interesting song and one that I do occasionally go back to. It's just that usually when I'm making my way through this album, this is one that I end up skipping because I think it's probably one of the weaker songs.
Yeah, it's one where I can see that this is a metaphorical song. Like, the singer is not speaking as himself, but as a third-party thing.
Yeah.
Be it, you know, disease or fire or disaster, what have you.
Yeah.
But I feel like it's a weird tone shift in a way that the album doesn't really address. Like, it doesn't feel like it has enough of the uplifting part that matches the rest of the album.
Yeah.
And so it ends up just kind of there. I think it has a weak start.
Yeah, I would say that it's like, it has a bit of a weak start. The lyrics are good for the purpose of the song, but, like, it's just a song that I every when it comes up every now and again, I'm just kind of like, eh. Mm. But But I do really, really like the ending stinger, which is like after the singer has killed your family and is going to and is, you know, now proceeding to kill you too. The stinger is, if I don't go to hell when I die, I might go to heaven. If I don't go to hell when I die, I might go to heaven. And then finally, if I don't go to hell when I die, I might go to heaven. I might go to heaven, but probably not. It's this really powerful little, like, I like it. This is the reason that I'm like, I don't think this is a bad song. It is a song that I just don't like listening to often, but when I do, it hits. Because, like, there's something really visceral about that, where it's like, this is already from the perspective of somebody who's like, I'm going to kill your family and murder you as well. And the audacity on it to be like, you know, if I don't go to hell, heaven's still there. Like, I might just be going to heaven after this. I don't know. Yeah. There's something really, like, there's something in the irony there for me.
Like, to this person, this character, it's not set in stone that their actions have damned them.
Yeah.
But then there's the, or I might not, which is, like, it could just be, probably not going to heaven, but it could also be more of the atheistic sort of, I don't know if I'll go to heaven anyways, you know?
Yeah.
Like, the maybe not is just, or there could just be no afterlife, or the afterlife could be different. Who knows?
Yeah.
It's interesting. It's a lyric that's left up to interpretation that feels like it's given meaning from the repeated line before it, but it doesn't necessarily need that meaning. And when you sort of take a closer look at it and start to brush off the layers of repetition, it starts to lose that original meaning and goes into something different and maybe as profound.
Yeah, the theism and atheism and sort of like the fraught relationship between like nihilism and, you know, just things that are like the idea that morality exists itself, essentially, is a theme that bounces around this album every now and again. And so I feel like this song is intentionally supposed to be just kind of like the darkest shade of nihilism. It's you know, this is an album that I don't think ends with "and nothing matters," but like this is one that has to contend with that. And so I think that that's the purpose of this song, is sort of like, if nothing matters, what's to stop me? You know, what is to stop all of the bad things in the world from just kind of happening and it not meaning anything? And again, I don't think, like, I think that is something that a lot of nihilistic material has to contend with, is the ultimate question of, well, if nothing matters, why do we do anything? And so, yeah, I think this is sort of the expression of that idea.
Okay, No More Tears, next song.
No More Tears. This is a very quick one. This starts sort of the first suite of like three really quick songs. This one is honestly just kind of an unabashedly positive song.
Mm-hmm.
I really like this.
It's describing a utopia.
Yeah.
With nothing bad like Hummers or yeah. SUVs.
No more SUVs, no more Hummers, no more racism, no discrimination, but most importantly, no more fucked up fucks keeping people out of our nation.
Yeah.
This is one that I sing to myself a lot. Every once in a while, I just kind of hum it. It's a really cute little, it's after something that's very, very downer. This is a big upper. Mm-hmm. And I really like it.
It's nice.
Yeah. That's kind of all I have to say about it. Do we want to move on to the next one?
Yeah. Bells and Whistles, another short one.
Yep. This one is honestly, genuinely, like, my third favorite song.
Interesting.
Yeah, I know that that's probably not going to be the standard thing, but, like, I have a big like for songs that start and don't stop. Just, like, Hall in 1945, Bombs Over Baghdad, most of it is kind of very similar. And, like, yeah, Bells and Whistles just kind of starts and it doesn't stop. Fun fact, we don't have to go to the fact corner because this is fun, unlike the fact corner, which is serious business. The lyrics themselves are a direct reference to a Stephen King short story, The Breathing Method. I'm glad that I knew that offhand. You're going to edit around this to make me look cool, right?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Except for this part.
Of course. Wait, what? This part? Oh, no! So, yeah, the lyrics are a direct reference to a Stephen King short story about a decapitated pregnant woman who gives birth. But I personally like to interpret the song as sort of like about trauma, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think it's kind of about generational trauma. I think it's also kind of just about, like, the general trauma of living in the world we're in. But that said, this is also one that I kind of, like, occasionally hum to myself. I try not to do it too much because the lyrics themselves are kind of fucked up.
Mm-hmm.
But I really like it. This is a really, really good song for just kind of like, it's very carnal. It's very visceral. I'm going to say visceral, not carnal. It's very cathartic, I think.
That's fair. Yeah. I really like the line, his soul too big to fit in his body.
Yeah.
I think that implies either that his soul, something about it is so great that he can't hold on to it. Like, whether it's the weight that he carries or some other sort of factor to it, or it implies that his body is too weak to hold the soul.
Yeah.
Too small, too tight. I don't know. But yeah, there's like, there's sort of a mismatch of like the physical maximum you can take and the emotional, spiritual maximum you can take.
Yeah, yeah. I also like, yeah, his heart will be bloated and swollen just like his soul, because the heart being, you know, the sort of like the capacity for love. It paints a picture of somebody who, you know, like is too empathetic, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, this is...
Or is loaded with so much emotional weight and pressure.
Yeah.
That it gets to be too much.
Yeah. Again, very cathartic song. Love mm-hmm. this one. But moving on to the last of the quick song suite, we have Randy's House, which is also the fastest.
I like Randy's House.
I like Randy's House
because it's the fastest.
It's so, yeah. Yeah, the other ones, I picked up the lyrics just by listening to them over and over again. Randy's House, I had to look up.
Mm-hmm.
Could not do it. But
at first I thought it was Granny's House, and I wasn't looking at the name of the song.
Oh, hello, welcome to Granny's
welcome
House.
Welcome to Granny's House. Would you like this candle? I blew it up.
Would you like, I'll make you dinner, just don't knock over my candle, please.
Oh no, you knocked over all of my candles. And now the fire's gone everywhere. This is about a real life event that happened. Somebody's house yes. burnt down.
Yeah, yeah, a friend named Randy, or somebody they knew named Randy, their house burned down.
Yeah.
It's a direct reference. But, the last line is kind of the big stinger of, I hope our candles flicker and die so that our hearts don't burn to the ground. Let me try that one more time. I hope that our hearts don't, our candles flicker and die so that our hearts don't burn to the ground, down, down, just like Randy's house. And I think it fits in very well with the consistent theme of death. I think it fits in very well with kind of like the existentialism. It's this pining that your death won't hurt that many people, which on one hand I think is, you know, a noble goal. On the other hand, I also think like it's meant to be taken critically. It's like, well, you can hope that, but you know, people still love you. People are going to hurt when you die.
Yeah. I think like the one thing that fills me with like existential anxiety is the prospect of losing a home.
Yeah.
You know, I really have empathy for people that don't have homes and lose homes, because like that's such an important thing, just having a place to live. And so like, you know, Randy's house burning down, terrible event, really uproots a person. But like comparing that to, you know, our hearts, our lives, I hope we can be passionate and live full and fast so that like we don't lose our entire sort of center point.
Yeah.
We don't lose our focal center of our lives. I don't know. That's something so powerful of like comparing your own life to the house, and that you don't want your house to burn to the ground because then you're you know, you're nowhere.
Yeah.
You don't want your heart to burn to the ground because then you're nowhere.
Yeah. Your house has all of your memories. Your heart has all of your memories as well.
I think your brain has all your memories.
Well, the ancient Egyptians would have something to say about that. So the next one is a song dedicated to the memory of Stormy the Rabbit. I'm going to call it Stormy for short. Stormy is a really, really poetic take on like houselessness.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really good, like, just the line of foraging forests, 5 footsteps in length, fortitude found within 40-ounce bottles. Like, it's a really, really deeply, you know, sad, deeply poetic song about somebody going through a struggle. It's fitting that it comes right after the song about your house burning down, too. I think that has, you know, thematic weight to it as well.
Mm-hmm.
And we once again see the theme of, like, I hope that in the end my death can be something, you know, like useful or beautiful. Although in this case, it's sort of like the ending line is like asking essentially that my corpse at the very least can bring some purpose to this world. The implication being that nothing else I have done is. And once again, while I would say that, like, that's not, you know, true, people tend to have connections far greater than themselves, that's definitely a feeling I've felt multiple times. That's, you know, something that you struggle with a lot when you have anxiety or depression. And so, yeah, I think this is a wonderful song to describe that feeling of isolation, both literal and metaphorical.
Memory for Stormy the Rabbit reminds me a bit of O Comely in a weird way.
Yeah.
Like, it is this sort of poetic, somber centerpiece that the album builds up to. It's not a climax. It is a low max. A climen.
Yeah.
A climen.
It's a denouement. Or yeah. Not a denouement. Well, denouement. Because denouement is after the climax.
Yeah.
I think that this is the climax of the album too, because both covers, the cover itself is Stormy the Rabbit, and there was like special edition cover that was a bee, and so I think, yeah, this is sort of the like central song.
Mm-hmm. Is Stormy the Rabbit related to Pat the Bunny?
Maybe, but I think really they're both cousins of Sonic the Hedgehog.
Mm. Yeah.
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 Stormy the Rabbit would be a good Sonic OC name, actually.
Well, there's Storm the Eagle, and there is Cream the Rabbit.
Yeah. Is that a
wait, is Storm,
that a name
no,
or
is
a command?
It Storm the Eagle? Shut up. You better be lucky there's that, like, the oldest character in Sonic fiction is Cream's mom.
Yes. Wait, no, isn't... Oh, wait, no, yeah. It's Vanilla. Never mind.
Is Storm an eagle, or is... Am I thinking of the albatross?
I think you're thinking of Hawkeye the Eagle from Animal Crossing.
No, I'm thinking of Storm Eagle from Mega Man X. I've been on the Mega Man X grind. It's fine. So yeah, Memory of Stormy the Rabbit, great song, very somber. Not one I often listen to outside of the album, but you know, it's in the context of the album, it's great.
Yeah.
Next is People 2, The Reckoning. That's right, they did this before People 1.
Yep. And the People 2 is specifically stylized, it is consistently stylized as capital I, lowercase I.
Interesting.
This is my favorite song on the entire album.
Yep, that checks out.
I love this song so much. This is a again, I'm going to say the word cathartic, it's a downer. It's kind of like just a song that is lamenting how unforgiving the world is, and it just kind of like... It's an expression of anguish. It's an expression of, you know, the existential dread of existence. I think that it is fun and interesting that it comes before People, because I think it's kind of a statement of, like, we often look about the bad before we look to the good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just...
That's interesting, because, like, this album is kind of structured the opposite.
Yeah.
That a lot of the utmost positive ones are at the start, except for maybe Bad Things, but, like... The first three, definitely, I feel like, are overall positive.
Yeah.
Maybe Brave as a Noun in a weird way. It's major key, but yeah.
Yeah. I think Brave as a Noun does have its own positive message, sort of specifically. So certainly the fact that I think it's, like, the, quote, breakout is the one that, like, aside from maybe People too, the one that's most likely to pop up in your Spotify Wrapped, basically.
People too has a songwriting thing I really like, which is... describing bodily reactions purely on a scientific basis. So, like, it's easy to just say, you know, you're in fight or flight mode, but to preface that with your parasympathetic nerve reacts, like, it gives it sort of a separation between you, your personality, and your actions.
Yeah.
There is this layer of physical process, just natural, automatic process that, you know, impacts you before your mind even realizes it.
Yeah.
I think that is such an interesting statement in this, because, like, so much of this is describing situations without really saying much about them implicitly or explicitly, but implicitly it's like, you know, these are all just wrong. This is bad. This is depressing. I mean, it says like, you know, it's difficult or it's fake or what have you. But I feel like it's much more about the connections that the listener draws between all the different lines and like I said, a lot of implicit meaning behind them. But then to take these things that give very emotional responses and then to just say like, oh, but in the end, it's your eyes telling a nerve to react to something. That's yeah. Like, it has this weird fatalistic element to it, purely biochemistry. And yeah, it's an interesting sort of conclusion to the chorus.
Yeah, it's I like examining things under the lens that we are all just kind of like chaotic chemicals bouncing around in a brain, because like, you know, whether or not you have a spiritual belief, that is still true. Like, there can be more to it. And, you know, I'm not going to sit here and say that there isn't. I'm not going to sit here and tell you not to believe in something greater, but like, fundamentally, it is true that we are just kind of all products of weird biological impulses. And so like that remembering that, I think, really helps tie into the existentialism. I also want to commend the line that is objectively funny of like, there's a bad man in all of us, no matter who we are. There's a rapist and a Nazi living in your tiny heart. Child pornographers and cannibals and politicians, too. It's very good. And then my favorite line, my favorite part of the entire album is when it just echoes the chorus of Mrs. Robinson. I am going to try and not spend 10 entire minutes talking about how much I love this, but I love when songs like just kind of directly reference or like directly respond to another song. And this is such a beautiful example of that, because sort of like part of the message of Mrs. Robinson seems to be sort of like a, you know, things will ultimately be fine in the end. It's very sad that you're going through this trial. And this posits, is it really sad? Will anybody mourn you? And the fact that nobody really will mourn you, isn't that itself kind of a massive tragedy? And that's where it ends. It's you live in an unforgiving place.
It's interesting. I feel like the original Mrs. Robinson is purely in the personal side of like a frame of mind that Mrs. Robinson must go through. And this is like somebody who is a pragmatist or a realist coming and being like, no, actually nothing matters. And you're gonna die. People hate you. It sucks.
Yeah.
But, like, I think you can kind of marry both of those points in mind.
Yeah.
Like, you have to have the original Mrs. Robinson because this version, this refutation, is also true.
Yeah.
This is purely the external, whereas that one's the internal. And trying to sort of find the place to put one over the other is a conflict, but that's also a conflict that by quoting the original song and using this meta text really hammers home. It's that it's not just that it's playing off the lyrics of the original, but it's like by singing the original, it causes you sort of a shock when you realize that the lyrics are different the first time.
Yeah.
And then every time further, it plays off your memories of that original song.
Yeah. I love this song. This is, again, favorite song in the album. People One, though, is my second favorite, and we're getting to that.
Yeah, we have one more between the two, though.
We have Personal Space Invader,
which I think is something in Tom Sawyer by Rush.
It has the opening line of I gave birth to twin wire hangovers, which is so good.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, goodness. And that's the only note I have. So let's move on.
Yeah, I don't have much else to say about this. I mean,
I will say that I think that this song works as a kind of like a release. Because,
mm-hmm.
like, it's a song that's sort of interrogating the darker aspects. The line of, like, how can you put that straw up your nose when you know how Coke is manufactured? And it's you know, it's kind of like, it's a song that I think is about self-reflection. The idea of a personal space invader, like, sounds kind of like, on one hand, it sounds funny. On the other hand, I think the idea could be, like, essentially, you are a stranger to yourself, you know? like, you are your own personal space invader, because the song starts with him becoming the personal space invader.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, there's that. I also take it as, like, somebody who wants others to change has to be a personal space invader.
Yeah.
Like, the first verse kind of calls in a lot of isolation or just not wanting to deal with other people. But in order to really grow and be a better person, you do have to let people invade your space and invade their space.
Yeah.
If everybody just kept in their personal space, then it would be, there'd be too much distance, literally and emotionally and metaphorically and what have you.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the thing about the Coke is manufactured is like, the for one thing, it's like they do the straw up your nose like it's cocaine, but it does kind of reference Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a, you know, kind of funny, kind of haha, kind of neat, kind of little nifty kind of bit. But also, like, the people who would drink Coca-Cola, they obviously don't care that, you know, it's being manufactured by child labor.
Yeah.
Underpaid and overworked and all that and just, you know, dying from it. And the people who look at them and say, like, you know, hey, don't you feel bad about it? It's essentially we live in a society, like, yeah. or yet you complain about society.
Yeah.
Like, the personal space invader is the one who is like, don't you know how they produce Coca-Cola? And I don't know how to make this not sound like I'm just being kind of reactionary, but like... I mean, you already know my politics, you, the listener.
Yeah.
So you know I'm not like that. But I generally feel like that's sort of an idea, is that there's a way to enact change involving invading personal space, but it can go too far. But also, like, the people that would do cocaine, you know, like celebrities and rich people, not like addicts.
Yeah.
Or not like poor addicts, I should say.
Yeah.
People who are on the streets because of drugs...
Well, okay, I will say that addiction, no matter how rich you are, is a bad thing.
Okay.
But the
people who have their lives completely destroyed by drugs, I should say.
Yeah, it's I think that it's a call out post at, like, not just sort of like unhealthy coping mechanisms, but I think it can also work as, like, you know, oh, the rich businessmen doing coke. It's like,
yeah.
do the people who are on top doing this, you know, taking advantage of this labor, really care? And the answer is, you know, no, it doesn't. But
is this about Andy Dick? Now, interestingly, apparently Sean Bonnet?
Yes, Sean Bonnet.
Has gone on to say that he feels like these lyrics were too judgy of drug users in the past, and that, you know, if you're an addict, it's not necessarily your fault, I guess.
Yeah.
That, like, it's a little too accusatory.
I can see that lens. I think that it still works as a, like, I think it works on a level of, like, people who are addicted to drugs generally know that the drugs are killing them, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it kind of works as, like, once again, an expression of, like, you know, don't you know how that's manufactured? And it's like, yeah, I do, but it's, you know, I need it. So I need something to get me through this.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, that is a habit that a lot of people form with a lot of different addictions. See also Coca-Cola.
What did you just call me?
So the outro, though, does have a specific upbeat positive message as well. I like the line of, you know, for God's sake, you've got to be kind.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really good, like, it follows through into people, the first, and it, you know, it's a good, like, just message to really drive home the point of, like, this is an album that deals with sad things. It is not a sad album.
It is not an album that's telling you to be depressed in a spiral.
Yeah.
I think that's the thing is... So I was in a discussion about some other, like, folk punk bands, and there is a limit, I think, to at least what I can handle, where lyrics become too self-destructive and spirally.
Yeah.
There was, it was a song by the band Days and Days, but those are spelled differently. And it was, like, a lot about, like, you know, having struggles you're going through with like depression, anxiety. And there's a bit where like the singer talks about how they went on a road trip with their friends, but they were too like scared to leave the car, even though they got to this beautiful park mm-hmm. to like do a hike. And I was relating it to it so hard. And then the final line was like, but I'm just an asshole who doesn't deserve the support. And I was like, no, you were almost yeah. there, bro. You were almost. And it turned me off the rest of the song. Like,
yeah.
I can't listen to that song without remembering that, because I'm okay with songs that talk about these problems, but sometimes it gets too much of a spiral. And even like People Too sometimes feels like that.
Yeah. That's
where
fair.
It feels too much like a depressive spiral, where like, because this is something I used to do a lot and I went to therapy for it. And so like nowadays I have better techniques to deal with it. But I feel like if I was still having those episodes, those moments, this would be not great for my mental health.
Yeah.
And I can't sort of move past that. So when you have something like this that ends up being just like, you know, be kind, you know, be a good person, that is meaningful to me.
Yeah.
That even though there's all these problems, there is ultimately the least we can do is be kind.
Yeah. And that wraps right into People, I think. I think that's a good place to ramp back into People, because this is still my second favorite. I do think I personally, having had my own episodes on this show, as it were, I personally really like songs that kind of just start and then just like don't stop.
Mm-hmm. You said like 20 yeah. minutes ago.
Yeah. Hang on. Wait, let me rephrase that. I personally like songs that like kind of just focus in on the bad. I find it very cathartic, but I do also want off-ramps as well. Like, I like listening to People Too. I like listening to, like, No Children by the Mountain Goats. But I do still want that song at the end. I want that breath of fresh air to remind you that ultimately life is worth living. Ultimately, people are cool. People are good. My best friends happen to be people, and this is that song.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this song it's about people. I think it's interesting. So the like biocentrism in People Too is to sort of disassociate.
Yeah.
In this one, it's sort of biocentrism in that it moves past like the it has a whole section of like, you know, people are people regardless of skin, gender, anything, as it says. And I think that's like a weird sort of case of biocentrist thinking purely in the context of we're all the same species, so
yeah,
we're all people.
Yeah,
there's the lines that have been drawn. This is about social contracts.
Yeah,
there are lines that are drawn outside of what people would think are just like innate properties, and they're sold as innate properties, but if we can move past that, you know, there'd be no more tears.
Yeah. I have somewhat very recently been thinking about how, like, I think a lot of people are terrified. A lot of people are kind of inherently terrified of the idea that there is nothing more than this. And I have something I'm specifically going for here.
Okay, like, Reddit.
I understand this is going to sound a little bit, you know, a little bit enlightened by my intelligence, pushes up glasses. I think people have this aversion to the idea that we are just kind of a collection of impulses and meat and brain and fluids, and we're all just sort of sticky animals. And I think there is a kind of legitimate like feeling to be like upset about that. You know, what if there isn't anything more? But all I can really say is my counter to that is, if there isn't anything more, so what? We're still all people, we're still all human, we're still in this world that we are living in today. And, you know, even if when we go into the pale white yonder, there's nothing else, that doesn't take away from all the lived experiences we've had. That doesn't take away from the fun people that we know, the friends we've made, the experiences we've had, the laughs we've shared. And I think that this really kind of, like you said, I like the idea that it hits on sort of the bioessentialism in a positive light of like, hey, humans at the end of the day are people, and we're all people, and we all have to deal with each other.
I definitely didn't say bioessentialism.
Not bioessentialism.
That's something pretty bad.
Yeah, that's something very different and bad.
Yeah.
This take on it of just, you know, we're all people at the end of the day, it's kind of hippie bullshit, but you know what? I'm kind of a hippie bullshitter.
Yeah. I mean, my perspective for a very long time has been, if there is nothing, then I'd rather the world be a better place, and I'd rather make it better for other people.
Yeah.
And if there is, then whoever's judging me will judge me by my better actions.
Yeah.
So, like, there's no outcome that wants you to be hateful and spiteful and rude.
Yeah.
You know? So I try to live my life, you know, kind to others. And yeah, it's the same way. Yeah, it's like it's hard for me to I don't know. I tend to live life in a way where I try to view people as other people rather than like jerks or assholes. You know, if somebody honks at me in traffic, I'm like, oh, well,
yeah,
nobody got hurt.
Yeah,
as long as nobody's getting hurt and, you know, nothing bad's happening from that, it's whatever. They might be having a bad day or something. Except for the street racers that almost ran into my car.
Yes.
I was coming home from Combo Breaker in a car full of other people. And we were on like a highway that was getting construction. So it was like three lanes. And I was driving. There was a car kind of diagonal in front of me to the right, such that there wasn't really room for another car to go between us. It was a one space diagonal rather than a knight's move,
yeah,
if you will. They were in pawn territory. I could have en passant them.
Yeah,
but a car came up on the right side super fast, like 30 miles an hour faster than what I was driving, and I heard them, and I had enough wherewithal to slow down, knowing that they were going to try to pass me up, which they did.
Yeah.
And then another car came on the left, and luckily there was more space there. But everyone in my car was, like, absolutely freaked out, shell-shocked, like, blood-pumping, adrenaline-running, you know, just saved, you know, just short of a life-threatening moment. Life still flashing before their eyes, catching up to the current moment. And yeah. I was like, damn, those people suck, but also, I'm kind of good.
Yeah.
Just like, not to brag, but more in the sense that I'm really glad I was driving and had the attention and everything.
Yeah. I have avoided a number of accidents by, the one that I'll briefly tell is that, you know, we had, like, icy roads and I was driving home because it had started when I was driving. And I hit on the brakes, and I realized very quickly I was going to smash into the car that was in front of me on the off-ramp. So I quickly jerked to the right, and just, like, I'm essentially just parallel with the other car. Like, I ended up parallel right between the car and the, like, the concrete side of the off-ramp. And, like, I literally remember this half second where I held my breath, nothing happened, and I just let go, and I was like,
yeah,
okay, I'm safe.
Yeah
I am somebody who is very angry with the world that it is not better, and so I think songs like this kind of, like, you know, songs and moments and memories like this help remind me of why I get angry. I get mm-hmm. angry because the world can get better, not because the world is bad, quote unquote.
Yeah,
because, like, I think fundamentally a lot of people, I think fundamentally most people act in a generally moral way to what they know. And it's just sort of, you know, expanding that knowledge base and going, hey, try leftism. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, famously, the world ends with you. Expand your horizons.
The world is revolving.
Okay, I want to get back to the title of this album.
Yes.
So, People Who Can Eat People. For one thing, there's People 2 and People 1. People 2 is a lot more negative. People 1 is positive.
Yep.
People 2, I think, is the people that can eat people.
Yeah.
In the sense that people who can eat people, they're not necessarily cannibals, but it's like people who are okay with throwing others under the bus.
Yeah.
People who are generally misanthropic is, I think, the way I would explain it the most. And People 1 argues for philanthropy.
Yeah.
Argues for a much more positive framework to view other people in. And so the people who can eat people are lucky because they don't let themselves get hurt as much. They're not as open and vulnerable to other people because they're the ones hurting others. But also, like, is that actually lucky? Because the phrase people who can eat people are the luckiest people, it implies a moral judgment based on what we already feel. So, like, sure, the album claims they're lucky, but we know that cannibalism is evil.
Yeah.
And so it primes you to think about, like, I mean, are they really that lucky? I don't think that's what I would call lucky. And I think that's sort of the goal point here, is that in any sort of circumstance, if you try to argue that being a person who will consume others that get close to you, don't open yourself up, don't help people, and generally just hate people, even if you try to argue that that is a good stance, it still ultimately falls short.
Yeah. One of the best tools that you have to counter sort of like toxicity is just kind of to really describe what the world is like for people who are toxic.
Mm-hmm.
It's technically, yes, you're lucky that you don't have to care about people. You can just sort of see them as, you know, items, machines, cogs, whatever, money. But like, that's such a myopic and stunted way of really seeing the world. And in acknowledging that people are cool, people are good, it is good to want to know more people and to spend your time with people and not treat them like objects. That's when you really achieve a sense of happiness and community.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. This is a wonderful album. I can see why it is on Mew, beyond just being a thing about white guys talking about feelings, which is a lot of Mew albums.
Yeah. I think, again, folk punk as a whole, while it's still a diverse genre, it does feel like it's focused around the emotion of the song portrayed through traditional instruments and, you know, very poetic lyrics.
Yeah.
And, like, I think, going back, not to say he's a bad singer, but the singer's voice... Is it Sean that sings?
Yeah, Sean is the singer.
Sean's voice is just so, like, perfect for that job.
Yeah.
It's he portrays so much emotion, screams his heart out, and that's kind of beautiful.
Yeah. It's a song that feels bursting at... It's a voice and an album that feels like bursting at the seams of trying to contain, you know, the emotion that is felt through all of it.
Also, I gotta say, just quick touching on some of their other albums, or one of their other albums.
Yep.
Knife Man is pretty good, but I hate the first song on Knife Man. That's all.
Dang. Personally, I don't like Knife Man. I'm a bigger fan of Particle Man.
Triangle Man beats Particle Man.
He does beat Particle Man. But Universe Man is the size of the entire universe.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, you know, this is a question I posed off camera. So, alright, on the tier list of Particle Man... We have Universe Man at top, obviously. He's the size of the entire universe. And then Triangle Man beats both Particle Man and Person Man. But Person Man can survive a frying pan to the head.
Yeah, I think Particle Man's still stronger than Person Man, though.
Well, to be fair, yeah. I guess water does technically get him instead.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe.
Which implies that if you were to hit Particle Man with a frying pan, the frying pan would get hit by Particle Man.
Ah, I like it. I like it. Anyway, catch us next time when we're going to do a tier list of the Particle Man men.
Yes. Until then, you can follow us on any podcasting platform you like. Give us a like, give us a rating, give us a review, give us a comment, let us know how we're doing. Let us know what you want us to cover in the future or what things you think we should check out anyways. You can also follow us on Twitter at NetSurferPro, where we post teasers on upcoming episodes. We post sort of updates on things going on. There's been some big personal life events going on recently, so episodes are a bit sporadic so far.
Yeah.
Hopefully we can settle down in the coming month or so and get things back to consistent schedule, but we'll see.
Yep.
But that's why you should follow us on Twitter to get other updates on when we get our episodes live, as well as on any podcasting platform. You can follow me on Twitter at Twakaroo, that's Twakaroo, where I post, updates on projects I'm working on, stuff I like, thoughts, bits, and also when I go live on my stream. which is on twitch.tv/twack. That's twitch.tv/twak. I stream most weekdays from about 1 p.m. Central Time to 3 or 4 p.m. Central Time. I stream a lot of roguelites, competitive games. I play Hitman a lot. And recently, I have been doing Mega May, which looks like it's currently June, so I guess it's now Jump and Shoot June? Except that would be referencing sequelitis, which I don't want to do. But where I play through every Mega Man game, 1 through 11, and every Mega Man X game, X through X6. So, I mean, I'm skipping a few, but, you know. But 17 Mega Man games to celebrate, or not really celebrate, but to commemorate having 17 years of type 1 diabetes. I'm fundraising for the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation, and while the main sort of fundraising drive they were doing has ended, I believe that the actual Tiltify campaign and donation page will be up through the end of June.
Nice.
So if you want to support me, check out the stream, and if you want to support diabetes research, check out that fundraiser.
Nice, nice. Rockman Rajun, by the way.
No.
Rock June? Roxanne.
You don't have to go to the red light. That's not even what the lyric is, but...
You can find me, by the way, on Twitter and on TikTok at Galen Wilson. That's at GalenWilson0n, where I post my hot takes and some videos. I'm actually really excited to be doing more videos. There's been a lot of fun, interesting things that I want to just like share quick thoughts on. So follow that if you want some like mini YouTube essays, more or less. Speaking of which, you can find me on YouTube at The Only Galen on YouTube, where I might have a normal video essay one of these days.
Yo.
And you can find me on Twitch at twitch.tv/machinegunvampire, where every time I say it, but I might be streaming sometime soon. I might have finally found the thing for me.
Nice.
For me.
Good luck.
Yep.
Is it a horror game? Because I'm not going to be responsible for that again.
It might have to be Who's Lila.
Lila balls.